Today's Taisho will be on case 23 in the Hikigan Roku, the Bienlu, the Blue Cliff Record. Case 23 is entitled Hofuku Points to Myohocho. Engo's introduction. Jade is tested by fire, gold by a stone, a sword by a hair, water by a staff. In Zen training, the degree of one's attainment and one's progress is known by one's words and phrases, one's attitudes and actions, one's comings and goings, one's asking and responding. Tell me, how will it be done? See the following. Main subject, when Hofuku and Choke went out for a walk, Hofuku, pointing with his finger, said, "This is Myohocho, marvelous peak, Myohocho, marvelous peak." Choke said, "What you say is well said, but alas." So basically he says, "Yes, it's true, it is a marvelous peak, but what a shame for you to say so." That's a better translation. Secho puts in his comment, "Today walking with this man, what is he plotting?" But again he says, "I don't say we do not find such men as this once in 100 or 1,000 years, but they are rare." A monk related to Kosei said, "But for Choke's remark, the field would have been littered with skulls." Secho's verse, "This is marvelous peak. Now weeds grow rampant. You see it clearly, but to whom could you impart it? If you, O Choke, didn't discriminate, many would never know and their skulls would litter the fields." Thank you all for coming to practice this morning and for sitting so still and so well. Really excellent. I very much like this translation of the koans, two Zen classics by Katsuki Sakida. And his translations are usually pretty good, but this translation I shouldn't have used. I think there are better translations, and I'd like to explain what actually happened. Hofuku and Choke are Paofu and Zhangjing. So for some reason, the Japanese know Paofu as Hofuku, and Zhangjing, they translate his name as Choke. So Paofu and Zhangjing go out for a walk, and Paofu, they're going through the forest, and they're walking, or I should say in the mountains. They're walking in the mountains, and they're exploring, and suddenly they come above the tree line, and they see this peak. It's called a Marvelous Peak, okay? So they're walking along in the forest. They come out into a clearing, and suddenly they can see this peak, and Paofu says, "Oh, it's Marvelous Peak," or Mystical Peak is another way to translate it. It's Mystical Peak. And Zhangjing turns to him and says, "Yes, you know, it is, but what a shame to say so." See, what a shame to say so. See, that's the koan. That's the essence of the koan. Okay. So, you know, this koan is often understood by people who don't know Zen very well as warning us not to rely too much on words, right? Don't rely too much on words. But really, this koan is about much more than that. You know, it's really profound koan. You know, these two, basically student and teacher, very senior student and his teacher, Zhang Jing, are walking in this beautiful part of China. And, you know, basically, they're just exploring to explore, sort of like aimless wandering, very wonderful thing to do, you know. And then they come into this clearing and they see this peak. And Pao Fu immediately remembers that this is called Marvelous Peak. And he says, oh, there's Marvelous Peak. And then Zhang Jing says, oh, yeah, right. I wish you know, but what a shame to say so. So, you know, the koan is really about how we have moments of real openness in our lives, and then we close down again because of our habitual patterns, mental habits, right? And sometimes those mental habits are have to do with language, like naming things. But it doesn't have to be just about giving things a name. It's about losing something alive and special in our interactions with each other and the world. So the you know, you might sit with this koan a long time, and if you say, well, it's just about don't use words, he could have pointed and it would have been the same problem, see? Okay. Many years ago, I had a chance to do some hiking in the Shenandoah Mountains when I was in college. I was just a college student. And I had been reading a lot about hiking. I wanted to try it. As if you know me, you know that I've spent 50 years hiking. You know, I love to go into the mountains, the Tetons, Cascades, the Wind River Range, you know. But when I was 18, I had never hiked, you know. And I was in college, and I was reading about hiking. Some of the writers I was reading liked to hike. So I and my friend Larry Sullivan, who I still hike with, you know, 50 years later, we made all these plans, right? We came up with a route, a 50-mile hike, and we planned it all out. This is in the beautiful Shenandoah National Park in Virginia, northwestern Virginia, very beautiful. And we planned it all out day by day. It was like a 7-day hike. We were going to do 50 miles. And we did our homework. We studied. There were campsites along the designated campgrounds along the way. And so we planned to walk a certain amount each time. We really planned to walk about 10 or 12 miles each day. And, you know, these designated campgrounds were supposed to have water, you know, so we could replenish our water and cook our meals. And actually, they have these little like shelters where you don't even need a tent, right? You can. So this was our first hike, and we wanted to do it right. We went to like a Wilderness Outfitters. We got some equipment, and then we set out. And because we didn't know much about hiking, we were carrying like way too much stuff. You know, so we had too much food and the wrong kind of food, like heavy. I think I even was carrying some cans of things, you know. And so, you know, we had these packs, and when I put them on, it was, you know, like unbearably heavy. Right? I think now our packs were more than 50 pounds, maybe 60 pounds. We were both in pretty good shape, but the packs were so heavy, they were hard to put on. And, you know, when we set out on the trail, we were straining like immediately. Right? And, you know, we were supposed to do 12 miles that day, but the packs were so heavy and it was so hard that we didn't make our goal. You know, I think we did like 5 miles. We were beginners. You know, we had just bought new hiking boots. After walking 5 miles with these very heavy packs, we had blisters on our feet and so on. So, you know, we had sleeping bags, but we actually didn't bring tents because we didn't plan to stay out in the open air. And, you know, luckily it didn't rain that day, but, we didn't bring like mosquito repellent, you know, so we slept in we had to zip ourselves into our bags. And, you know, every day was kind of like this. You know, it was like every day something would not go according to the plan. At first this caused us a lot of distress. You know, we really wanted this to be done right. And I remember reaching this shelter talking to this very seasoned hiker, and he sort of went through all the things we did wrong, you know, with us. And I should say that pretty much everything that could go wrong on this hike went wrong. We came to one shelter, and it was so full of hikers that, and it did rain. You know, we couldn't get a bunk. We slept on the cement pad that the little cabin was built on, and we didn't have really good air mattresses. And one time, the water was like a mile away, so we had to walk a mile at the end of a long day of hiking just to get water for dinner. You know, pretty much everything went wrong. I ate some blueberries. I picked a bunch of blueberries, and I had some kind of allergic reaction to the blueberries, and my face swelled up. You know, a couple of times we thought just about quitting, but you know, we actually stuck it out right to the end. And my friend Larry, his backpack, which was kind of a cheap backpack, actually fell apart like on the last day. So, you know, I was talking to him just a couple days ago because we were thinking of doing a hike this summer. And we were talking about that first hike, and he burst into laughter because, you know, it should have been something we did once and never did again because it was just such a quote-unquote terrible experience. You know, but after it was over, It was like a magical adventure, right? It was like, it was as though all the things that went wrong didn't matter. You know, and if somebody had said, what was it about the hike that, you know, that you liked? What was it that the hike, you know, because that wasn't our last hike. That was our first hike in a lifetime of hiking. In fact, my friend Larry is even going on a three-week hike at the end of August. In California. He's hiking all the way to Yosemite from Southern California. So why wasn't that our last hike? And if somebody had said to us then, you know, how did the hike go? We'd have said it was terrible. But, you know, after it was over, it had this power, you know, as an experience. And that power has never let me go. Right? It was just like, never let me go. I've been hiking since then, pretty much every year for 50 years. And, you know, I can remember my first sesshin, right? Also, I've been doing sesshin for 50 years. I can remember my first Chan Chi. And, you know, I had started sitting at the Seattle Zen Center. And after just a couple months of sitting, I was still having a very hard time getting through an hour and a half of meditation. And, you know, but this very lovely Japanese-American woman, her name was Wendy Nakao, who was a student of my shifu, my teacher, Genki Roshi, my Roshi. She came up to me and had this beautiful smile on her face, and she said, "Would you like to go to Sesshin?" And I didn't know what a Sesshin was, but I said, "Yes, sure, I'd love to go to Sesshin." So I had not had much practice, and I signed up to go to this Sesshin. And, you know, the Sesshin was really challenging, you know, for me. I hadn't done much meditation, and, you know, by the end of the first day, my legs were hurting me so much, right? I couldn't really sit with my, in the normal, in any of the normal postures by the end of the day. Usually I was sitting Burmese style with my legs just in front of me. And I did try to sit Seiza with my legs under me and some pillows under my bottom. But by the end of like the first day, no matter what posture I was in, I started to have muscle cramps. I didn't leave because the Sesshin took place on an island and there was nobody, no way to get off the island. On Vashon Island in Seattle, in the Seattle area. So I didn't really want to quit, but you know, the next day my legs were a little better, but not much. And I remember when I went in to see Genki Roshi in Dokusan, you know, you're supposed to go into Dokusan, bow, and actually you're supposed to sit, in Japanese temples, you sit Seiza on your, without a cushion under you. You just sit on your heels, basically. And I couldn't do that. In fact, I was so, I was in so much pain, I actually was sort of like crawling into the room. And, you know, the whole Sesshin was like that, in a way, you know. But, you know, when it was over, I didn't say, "Oh, I will never do this again." But if somebody had said, "How did the Sesshin go?" I would have said, "Oh, I was in pain all the time. You know, I couldn't sleep because the guy next to me in the bunkhouse snored all night. You know, I couldn't, I was constipated, you know, basically for 7 days," and so on. But when it was over, it had so much power. You know, I remember going back to Seattle after the Sesshin, and I was a teaching assistant in the English department. And it was like the day after Sesshin, I had to go in and teach my class. And I said something to the class, and I turned to the board, and I was going to write something. And my mind just went completely blank. It's like Wuxin. Like, I didn't know about Wuxin, but my mind went completely blank, right? And when I turned around to face my students, I was like in having sort of a panic attack because I couldn't remember what I was supposed to say. You know, I made some small talk or something till I recovered. But, you know, that experience was absolutely gripping. And I signed up for the next Sesshin right away. And if somebody had said to me, "What is it about Sesshin you like?" I couldn't have said, I like Sesshin because, I couldn't have said, you know, if somebody said, "Well, tell me about Sesshin," I said, "Well, my legs were in pain. I was in pain all the time. I couldn't sleep. I was constipated for 7 days," and so on and so on. They'd say, "Well, did you answer your call?" No, I didn't. I didn't even get close. You know, so what was it about Sesshin that, you know, I think these experiences are similar because when we were hiking, we expected, you know, like a travel book experience, right? You know, there are all these guides, they have topographical maps. They, you know, if you're you're supposed to be able to get from point A to point B, and, you know, you can pace yourself, you can increase your pace if you want to be competitive with yourself. Those are all highly controlled experiences. You know, what happened to us when we were hiking in the mountains as complete inexperienced, we say in English, greenhorns. We were totally inexperienced. We made all the mistakes. But it was like encountering something so powerful. We couldn't say what it was, but there was a kind of energy to the experience, like an energy, right? And you know, that, I think, if I had been astute enough or awake, if I'd done enough Zen, I would have been able to say, oh, the thing about the hike was the energy, right? And, you know, the thing about my first Sesshin was the energy, right? The energy. It's like, now I think I have a much better understanding of what happened to me in those two times. You know, we actually spent a lot of time keeping ourselves under control and keeping our life under control. And we don't even pay attention to this, you know. It's like, you know, we're always a little bit cautious in our lives. It's like we're always trying to distance ourselves from things a little bit and control things a lot, right? And by the way, if you get to be an experienced person who goes to many Sesshin, and I hope you do, you can get like this with Sesshin. You know, you can get very skillful about getting through Sesshin. You can avoid having too much pain. You can, you know, and you should do that. Please, you know, use your head when you're at Sesshin. But nevertheless, you know, we spend a lot of time protecting ourselves from the world around us. We don't do it consciously. You know, we are constantly like holding the world a little bit away from us. And for our own protection, you could say, really, for our own protection. And we're also trying to control things so that we don't get in over our heads, so that circumstances don't overwhelm us, you know? So, nobody likes being lost in New York City, you know. But I have a phone now, an iPhone. But before I had an iPhone, you know, I would look at street maps, but I would get so lost in New York, right? And I don't enjoy the experience of being lost. I wish I did, but you know, sometimes I've gotten so lost that I actually like am panicking, right? Like. And then I say to myself, well, why are you panicking? You know, you'll be okay. You know, there's probably a subway line one street over. That experience of being lost is an unpleasant experience, right? But, you know, we're doing this all the time. And you know, if you begin to look at how much of your life is controlled by, like, life management and habit, right? And some of this is necessary, right? Like, you know, when my gas gets to be half full in my car, I don't like to run it down to one bar. You know, I like to have it filled. So if it gets to half full, I refill it. That's like, but there was, you know, we spend so much time managing our lives and distancing ourselves from uncertainty, right? That, you know, after a while, our lives become sort of like, it's like the energy drains out of our lives. And if you add to that, like, we all have like every human being, I think, you know, I have anxiety drains a lot of energy that we have, right? So, you know, if I have to meet new people in my job, you know, especially when I was younger and less experienced, you know, if I had a meeting that was an important meeting, when I went to the meeting, even if it went well, you know, I would come home and I would just be wiped out. I remember I had just gotten this new job at Rutgers, and I had to meet with my staff, who I had never met before. And I was just out of graduate school myself. And some of these people were 10 years older than I was. I was so afraid they were going to think I was incompetent. So I went to this meeting, and they were all very friendly and nice. But when I came home from the meeting, I was just, it was like for the rest of the afternoon, I was emotionally drained. So I think, you know, we spend a lot of time protecting ourselves from the unforeseen. And we spend a lot of time actually sort of like managing our own anxieties and keeping ourselves under control. And that's very exhausting, very tiring. So basically, you know, we live a life of patterns and habits and control. And in some ways, this makes perfect sense. But on the other hand, it really robs us of that magical energy that I experienced when I did my first hike in the Shenandoah Mountains, or when I was on my first sesshin. You know, there's a psychologist who has written a number of books on what he calls the flow experience, right? And you know, I like it. I've read a couple of his books. Like, you know, sometimes you're just struggling, right? Sometimes you're struggling. And then sometimes the struggle just stops and you're just going along with the situation. And those moments are really beautiful, really wonderful. But I think that in order to have those moments, right, it's not just a matter of looking for them. You have to develop what we in Zen call a nowhere dwelling mind, wuxin, nowhere dwelling mind. Right? It's like, you know, when I first started in my job, and I had to go meet my staff for the first time, you know, I was anxious about every event that happened, right? It was like every event that happened caused me to be anxious. You know, I've done my job for 35 years. You know, when I go to a meeting now, it's like, well, we'll see what happens, you know? You know, when I first started teaching, I used to plan my lessons out really carefully. And what would happen is I would have a lesson plan, and then I would start talking to my students, and the conversation would never stay in the lesson plan, right? You know, we might be talking about something like, I'm an English teacher, so I might be talking about a scene in a play or a poem. And, you know, I had this whole lesson about this, and, you know, I'll start talking with my students, and I realize, you know, they don't like it, it's not they find it boring, or, you know, the discussion is just going in a direction I didn't expect, and I didn't really want it to go in. This still happens to me all the time. But when I was a beginner, this would absolutely terrify me. Right, as my class was deviating from the lesson plan more and more, I would get more and more anxious. And after the class, I would come back and I would feel like such a flop. You know, I'd feel like, oh, if somebody said, "How did the class go?" I'd say, "Terrible." You know, we didn't cover anything in the lesson plan. Right. You know, if you flash forward 30 years. You know, I am so happy that my students want to talk, you know. And if they don't say what I expect, it's even better, right? It's like, oh, you know, an original insight. It's, you know, I didn't think, and I'll say, I didn't think of that. That's really interesting, you know. And then you can start talking. 80 minutes goes like this. You know, it's like the Tao, right? It's like the unfolding of the Tao. It's like, I'm not trying to control the situation. I don't have a particular outcome in mind. And I have to say, sometimes the conversations get, you know, really complicated. And, you know, sometimes we're dealing with things that are pretty controversial. I don't want to have somebody explode emotionally in class. It can be a little nerve-wracking sometimes. But on the other hand, it's so alive, so alive. So, you know, I think that we, for good reasons, you know, plan, prepare, you know, all of those things are good. But you know, I think that a more skillfully lived life is, there's like an art of not controlling things. There's like an art of opening up to things as they unfold. And I think that Chan or Zen is all about that, right? It's like learning how not, learning to control things is an important skill, but it's very limiting, right? And learning how not to control things, I think, is a superior skill. It's like superior. Way of living, right? So you know, I didn't know when I first started Zen how valuable it was to be overwhelmed by the situation, right? You know, if you know anything about Zen, we work on what are called koans, gungan, and you know, the teacher will give you a koan, like the one I'm talking about right now, and you will go into deep ushin and internalize the core term, see? So basically, you're working with this story, and you're supposed to have an insight. You know, and what most people try to do is to think about the story in terms of something they already know, and then come in and explain the story. But see, that's not a living experience of the story. What you're doing is you're putting that story back into a familiar box, right? You're putting that story into like a familiar box. How can you have an open and original experience of the story? Or how can you have an open and original experience of anything? You know, a friend of mine has a relationship with her daughter. That's where they both it often ends up in conflict, right? So the daughter is like I don't know. I guess she's 18 or 19. She's in college. The mother had all these plans for her daughter. When she, you know, and now the daughter is like doing nothing that her mother wants her to do. And they have all of these conflicts. And, you know, this person was asking me about this. And you know, this is sort of her koan, right? You know, every time she interacts with her daughter, she just winds up repeating the same cycle. Right? And the daughter does the same thing. It's so hard to break out of this, right? Well, you know, a lot of Zen training is about this. You know, how can we step out of our familiar habits and experience the world in a fresh way? It's very difficult, actually, to do that. You know, in Zen, the core of Zen practice is the cultivation of wuxin, empty mind. Right? You know, an empty mind is like going back to zero consciousness. It's like the consciousness of zero. Right? So, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you go into wuxin, it's like you're putting aside or you're stepping out of all the mental habits you carry with you. And you know, if you keep practicing Zen, you learn how to live your life from this place, the empty mind. You know, so you know, things happen to us that we can't control. And you know, I have a friend of mine just now who is a scientist, a research scientist in the health sciences at a university here in New Jersey. And if you know anything about what's happening to the academic budgets around the country, especially in health research, you know, I actually had a dream last night where my friend was crying. I'm going to call him after the session because I'm so worried about him. You know, he is a really wonderful, generous person, and I don't know that his funding is being held up. But I know that he's been in that situation before, long ago. Many years ago, he was talking with me, and this is like 20 years ago, and he was saying how nervous he was about the delay in the funding for his lab. You know, he's an independent researcher affiliated with the university, so he has to make his own, he has to pay for his own lab, actually. He has to hire his own assistants. And in fact, the university actually makes him pay a tax, you know, on using their facilities. So the university gets a lot of money from him, right? So, you know, I'm so worried about him because, you know, this is somebody who's done everything in life that he's supposed to do. Right? Everything in life he's supposed to do. He's compassionate, he's hardworking, and, you know, he is meticulous, maybe too much meticulous. I would say this is a loving comment. Maybe he's a little too meticulous. And, you know, now he's in this place that he doesn't control the situation. And I think this is this is the most difficult place you can be in, right? Because, you know, most people, when they're in that situation, they blame themselves. You know, they blame themselves because they've made a habit all their lives of being in control, right? It's not a criticism. But, you know, they've taken responsibility for everything in their lives, and they've made a habit out of, like, controlling everything. And, you know, when they're out of control, they don't know what to do, you know? And it's my experience that when people have that kind of experience, they very often blame themselves, right? You know, if you know anything about American history, you know, in 1929, the whole United States economy collapsed. 30% of the American workforce was out of work. That's one out of every three or four people was out of work. They say 25 to 30%. And, you know, these social scientists did all this research, and they found that practically all of the people who lost their jobs blamed themselves, right? Even though the financial system had collapsed, because they knew somebody who hadn't lost a job. So they said, well, if I were really good, I wouldn't have lost my job. And there was a lot of those people suffered a great deal from the illusion of controlling their situation. You know, we're in a place right now in the United States where many things beyond our control are happening. And we probably, if you practice Zen, you're probably somebody who has a lot of self-discipline and, you know, is very careful about how you live your life, you know, which is, those are all pluses. But, you know, in times of uncertainty, this ability to allow things to unfold, not take it personally, but be open to what's happening. This is easy to say, so hard to do. But, you know, if you do it, you will find you have all of this energy that you didn't think you had. all of this energy. You know, when we're in fear, we don't have energy. We can't think out of the box when we're afraid, right? You know, we tend to become most conservative and repetitive in our behavior when we're frightened. But that's just when we need to be out of the box. You know, and so much of Zen training is about how not to respond with fear to uncertainty, how not to respond with anger or self-blame. You know, you have to let yourself empty out and then trust the process that's unfolding in front of you. Trust the process that's unfolding in front of you. Now, you know, my friend whose research grant may not be funded as he expects, you know, he has many talents and abilities. You know, he spent 25 years in the same lab that he built, but, you know, I think he could probably go out to a pharmaceutical company, maybe in New Jersey, and get a job tomorrow. You know, we think we're absolutely trapped, but that's only because we're holding on to the past, and we can't see what might be unfolding right now, see. So this koan is all about this, right? I mean, these two Chan monks are wandering freely in the mountains, and then they have this experience, and one of the monks immediately says, oh, he takes that experience and he puts it into the familiar box, right? And now nothing new can happen, right? Nothing new can happen. So we all do that, but, you know, Zen is all about learning how not to put things in that box, right? You don't know what you don't know, right? In a certain sense, when you use your thinking mind, all you're going to do is repeat the patterns that you already have worked out, already acquired, and you're just going to repeat what you already know. But, you know, when we enter Wuxin, you know, there's deep unconscious processing that reveals to us other possibilities that we weren't aware of in our conscious minds. So I have to, you know, this is one of these days where I say this is two for the price of one. We just had a koan, Pao Fu and Zhang Jing. See a mountain, and Pao Fu says, oh, it's Mysterious Peak. Right? And that, in other words, he puts the new experience in the old box. Right? But there's another koan, which is case 49 in the Entangling Vines collection. And it goes like this. A monk asked Umong, Cloud Gate, what is the place from which all Buddhas come? What is the place from which all Buddhas come? Yunmen said, the East Mountain walks on the water. The East Mountain walks on the water. See, so what he's saying is that, you know, when you, first of all, our small mind says mountains can't walk, and they can't walk on the water. But what he's saying is, when we make a place in our lives for Wuxin, not knowing, many possibilities present themselves that we never dreamed of. You know, the mountain seems to be the last thing in the world that could walk on water, but that's only because our expectations lock us into stereotypical ways of thinking. Right? You know, things can seem at certain moments absolutely impossible to resolve, But that's always just our own mistaken view. In every moment, you know, in every moment, there are many possible futures. They're all available. They really, it doesn't mean that you'll win in the stock market. But at this moment, there are many possible futures. And the one I'm likely to take is the one I've always taken. But you know, if you practice Chan, if you practice Zen and you learn how to dwell in Wuxin, you realize I don't have to do this. You suddenly realize I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this, and I can, in any, you know, the best part of it is that all of them lead to enlightenment, according to the Buddha's teaching. You know, any choice, any road you take is going to take you to enlightenment, especially if you trust your big mind. Engo's introduction. Jade is tested by fire, gold by a stone, a sword by a hair, water by a staff. In Zen training, the degree of one's attainment and one's progress is known by one's words and phrases, one's attitudes and actions, one's coming and going, one's asking and responding. Your coming and going, your responding should always be from that empty place. Main subject, when Paofu and Zhang Jing went for a walk, Paofu, pointing with his finger, said, "Oh, look, it's Marvelous Peak." Zhang Jing said, "What you say is true, but what a shame to say so, right? You've missed your chance to experience something new." Secho's verse. This is Marvelous Peak. Now weeds grow rampant. You see it clearly, but to whom could you impart it? If, Zhang Jing, didn't discriminate, if you, O Zhang Jing, didn't discriminate, many would never know and their skulls would litter the field. Skulls littering the field means you live in a dead world, and a dead world is created by your habits and assumptions. And the world comes alive when you bring into it that empty mind. So I'm sure you had a taste of that today on the cushion, and please keep up the good work. Thank you. please have a seat. So please remember that tomorrow night at 7 on our usual, on the Dokusan Zoom link, we will have Dokusan. So if you'd like to have a private conversation with the teacher, please take advantage of that opportunity. Peggy, how was your sit today?
Well, I didn't get here for the sit, which made me feel very guilty, but the Teisho ended up making it quite lovely.
Right. Well, great. Glad
thank
to,
you.
Good to see you. Louise, how was the sit?
It was wonderful in so many ways.